The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast. We pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John May, and I can't say my name properly. Rejoining me this week is a slightly bruised James Baggett. James, I would ask how you are, but I sort of know the answers to that. But
not great, John. But I can understand why you can't speak. It was because it was our Christmas party last night, wasn't it? You probably had a few too many Proseccos. Is that the case?
No, I don't really do Prosecco because I'm not from Essex. No. Apart from that, you're on the money.
I wasn't here last week, was I? I had a last minute stand in from Rebecca, thankfully, because I was at the hospital. I've had a bit of a hellish couple of weeks. I've got a prolapsed disc, which sounds hideous, and it actually is pretty hideous. Last week, I had an injection into the nerve in my back while you were chatting away on the podcast. I was screaming at a man in a gown in a hospital. Pretty horrible. And it hasn't got any better. So today, guess what I'm going to do at the hospital today, John?
Is it have another one?
Yes. And this time it's an epidural, which you will know is normally what happens when people are pregnant or are giving birth. But
I was going to say, you're hardly showing at all.
No, it was quite a big Christmas dinner last night. But no, yes, I'm going to have that at 4 o'clock. And I must say, even talking about it has made my hands sweat. I am very, very nervous.
So this is sort of
taking my mind off things. So thank you for having me on.
I'm glad I could help. So it's been quite a busy week for news, hasn't it?
It has. It really, really has.
Don't go into details, obviously, because we'll talk about that. But yes. No.
There's the handy thing about having the back injury has meant that I haven't been able to sleep, which means that I've had a lot of time to work. So most days I've been starting work at 3:45 in the morning. And by the time people start work, I've done 5 hours and I've written most of the story. So I've really enjoyed that, John. I've had a lot of time to write.
Okay. Which has
been good. But yeah, thankfully there's been lots of stuff to write about, hasn't there, this week?
Yes.
We will come on to.
We will, yes. And if you're listening and you work in the press office of a major dealer group in the UK and you received an email from James at 3 a.m, that's why. He's not just an insomniac.
No, that is actually the truth. That did happen.
Oh, God. Okay, well, I'll introduce our guest then. So our guest this week is Scott Sibley from the award-winning dealership Redgate Lodge. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invite.
Anything. Lovely to have you on, Scott. Really nice to see you. I don't think we've had a proper chat like this before. So for those people listening, just explain a little bit about your business and where you're based and how it's set up.
So we're based in Newcastle upon Tyne. We've been going since 2010, so 13 years. We have two locations, two used car sites, and we've got a prep centre as well where we prepare all the cars. Do servicing, MOTs, body shop, diamond cut wheels, refurbishments, 45 staff, stock about 350 cars.
Wow. So 2010, what were you doing before that? What got you into the used car game?
So I trained as a chef when I left school. That was the first step. I did hotel management, the hospitality industry. So I did hotel management training. Then I was a chef for about a year and a half, 2 years. I set up my own catering business for about 6 years after that. After that, 10 years on, there was a friend of mine had he did computer games shops, you know, like Sony, Nintendo, all that kind of thing. So there was like a chain of shops. So I got involved in retail. So I did that for 10 years. And then I came out of that and set up Redgate Lodge. So Redgate Lodge is the name of our house. And I started selling cars from the driveway from the house, just like one at a time on the side.
Amazing. So yeah, a man after my own heart, because this is exactly what I'm planning with my new project, which you may have may not heard about, but you certainly will hear about today. So when you started off in the used car game, look, were you a car fan firstly? I mean, you've obviously had quite a varied career there, haven't you? In restaurants and then in retail. What took you towards cars?
So my dad, he was in the motor trade for years. He had a garage in probably the 70s, and then he ended up trading cars. So, you know, being a young lad of maybe, I don't know, 10 or 12 years old, I would maybe go to the odd auction with him. So my older brother, when he left school, he kind of teamed up with my dad, and he started, you know, they were trading cars around garages and main dealers and so on. And then when I left school, I wanted to do that, but my dad said there was only enough space for like one son to do that. So I said to him, well, what do you think I should do, Dad? And he says, well, he used to go to a local hotel in the Newcastle in the, you know, the 80s, which was quite special then, called the Gosforth Park Hotel. And he's quite friendly with the hotel manager. And he says, I think you should go into hotel management. He says, I think that would be a, you know, a good role and a good thing for you to do. And obviously you kind of listen to your parents. So that's how I ended up doing that. So I did that in catering. When I was working in the hotels, I mean, I was going probably 25, 30 years ago, I was working in the hotels. And in those days, unless you wanted to go down to London or go on the cruise ships, you're never going to make, you know, decent money. It's different now. It's different now. So obviously the chefs, even in the Newcastle area, they earn good money, but things were different then. So I wasn't prepared to move. So that's when I set up my catering business. So I started, had a couple of sandwich shops, and we started wholesaling sandwiches to like petrol stations and hospitals and so on. So we did that, but I was only like 22, didn't have much life experience, and we built that up. I built it up for 6 years, ended up doing 40,000 sandwiches a week.
Wow.
So we had like a big factory and staff and vans and a lot of headaches. We could never get the money in. We're supplying the likes of Komatsu, Fujitsu, Siemens, and you never get the money in. And the banks, they suggested we did factoring with the banks, and you factor the debt out.
Yep.
And that was the nail in the coffin. We couldn't get the mix right where they were giving us the money back. So it was basically cash flow. So I closed it in the finish.
Yeah, when I first started my business, when I started Cardio, I used factoring, and it was kind of sort of frowned upon, wasn't it? I mean, I don't know whether you found the same thing at the start, but it was someone came to me and just said, look, this is a great way, because cash flow was really, really difficult for me, because every month I had to pay for another print of the magazine. So I really needed to get the cash in. I was dealing with big businesses like you probably were, and getting bills paid in 60, 90 days was hard work. And as a small business, you need the money immediately, don't you? But it took me a long time to get off factoring, because once you're on it, it's like, I mean, you're borrowing, aren't you, constantly? And to catch up with it was really difficult. So I can see why that would have been a pain.
Yeah, it was hard. You were expecting money to come in, but then if the debtor didn't pay the factor, then the money wasn't coming in, and then they still wanted their money. And it was like a vicious circle, you know?
So when you started in car sales, I take it the cash flow was really important to you. I mean, did you put a lot of money in at the start of your own cash, or did you go out and have to get funding?
Well, I had at home, my little pot, if you like, was 20,000. So I had £20,000. And I was a bit naive, because even though my dad used to be in the motor trade years ago, and I mean, he passed a lot of years ago, so I didn't have any connection to the motor trade as such. Probably a bit clueless when I think back. Yeah, I started with 20,000, and I started just selling small cars, because I thought, well, there's so many cars out there, I can get me hands burnt here if I buy the wrong things. So I just stuck to rental Clios, which, believe it or not, so I bought and sold rental Clios for about, I don't know, maybe 2 years. And you'd have one on AutoTrader, but I used to have six in stock, and you sell six off the one advert, you know, the usual kind of things.
Oh, did you really? Wow.
Yeah, and then you used to get, you know, you'd know the models, and you'd know the faults if they broke down. You knew where there was some for spares. And that was my, because I didn't know anything about the motor trade. So, I didn't have like a mentor or somebody could say, you know, you need to do this, that and the other. So that's how I kind of set it up. And then when I came out of working for the computer games company, I had about six or seven cars on the drive. And we got a little unit on an industrial estate, which held about 15 to 20 cars. So we filled that up, and then we got the unit next door and the one next door, and kind of grew it from there. But then we still kept it as a small car specialist. So we had about maybe 50 or 60 cars in stock, which were all, you know, like Clios, Corsas, Fiestas, if you just passed your driving test, you want your low insurance. And where we were situated, which was north of Newcastle, we had to stick to that because we needed a reason for people to drive up there. You needed enough of that. So if I had 10 Fiestas, somebody's gonna buy one of them, you'd think. That was the thought behind it.
Amazing. So in those early days and to grow into what you've got to now, what were the big steps that you kind of remember? I mean, you talked at the start about having a prep center. I mean, this is one thing that all the businesses I talk to say is so important, because not only can you have the servicing work to supplement your sales side when it's quiet, but you can also get them to prep your cars and you can lean on them to do stuff a bit quicker for you when you need to get that car out. Was that one of the big things? Or was there something else that really, really helped you move on?
I would have said that, I mean, I was, again, naive. I didn't know about funding. And I used to look at all these garages and think, hey, they've got like a million quids of the stock there. Where'd they get that money from? And I thought, well, he couldn't go to the bank, because obviously my past experience with banks. So the finance companies were coming in and saying, oh, we're doing funding. We'll lend you 100 grand. And I thought it was like, you know, it was great. So the funding was really good to us. We used to max it out and we used to run it. You know, if you keep your eye on it, I think it's good. I think there's a lot of businesses out there where new people who come into the industry, they get involved with funding and it's a success for them, where a lot of the old timers like to just have their own money and don't have any debt. And, you know, they're a little bit old school. But I think, you know, if you, you know, to have a big stock level, I think our stock's about 3.5 million at the minute, and we've got money on funding. You know, you haven't got all the money yourself, you know. So the funding, I think, was crucial. And then prep work, yeah, like you said, when we were up at Bedlington, we set up a little workshop. But again, I've no motor trade experience. You get mechanics in, and they tell you they can do this and do that, and you just have to. I suppose with us, we just have to learn throughout the years. Mm. We've got 10 or 12 mechanics now. We've got two workshops, two MOT lanes. We've got workshop managers, service advisors. And so it's a different level to what we started with. But I think the key in this business now is all preparation. If you can prepare your cars faster and efficiently, you've got a chance. I mean, we've got the prep center now, which is 12,000 square foot, which has got the body shop. We've got two ovens in the body shop. There's a team of six in the body shop. And the other side of the building is just our Redgate Lodge sales cars, which get prepped. And I thought that's going to be the dream. We'll be able to prep these cars much faster. But all you do is you increase your stock level, and then the amount of cars in prep just are still behind. So we're currently expanding that. The workshop, we're putting another three vehicle ramps in, and we're taking on another three techs to come to the business to try and combat the cars, because we're selling them as they're coming in. We've been doing all right these last few months when it's been tough. We've still been doing the numbers, but we've started selling a few of the oldest cars as well. We've set up a new site which specialises in 4,000 to 10,000 pound cars. There's right. About 100 cars, which is an area I wasn't keen on, because the prep takes too long, because the older cars always need more prep. Even down to the valet takes longer, you know, and everything, it just slows the whole process down. So we've been caught out a little bit with that, with trying to stock that up and getting them. The cars have been selling, but the preparation time, we didn't take into account how things can just take so much longer. You know, you can have one mechanic on one car for 2 days, where, you know, the newer cars, 4 and 5 year old cars, they turn them around, you know, a service and some wiper blades, a couple of tyres, the cars are more in and out, you know.
So you've touched on it there about the market at the moment. I mean, we're hearing different things from lots of different people about how not tough it is out there. Sorry, you have to forgive me. I've had quite a lot of morphine, so I'm probably not making much sense. But what are you seeing out there, Scott? I mean, how busy is it, and what are you seeing in the market?
Well, I look at all the data, Auto Trader, you guys, and I listen and I read quite a lot of things. What's going on? For us personally, we've been doing all right. Yeah, we've increased our stock level, which I'd always think you'd probably then sell more cars. And because we've got, you know, that we've got Bosch Car Service Department. I've got a new aftercare manager in now. He telephones every single customer, you know, when they've been in for service, body shop, if they bought a car, within a week. So we're trying to increase the customer service level, and just. Yeah, I think the size of the business helps. I think if we'd stayed where we were, you know, like 30 or 50 cars in stock, I think you'd probably getting swallowed up by some of the bigger outfits.
So I think. And What sort of stuff is selling at the moment? You mentioned that this 4 to 10 grand area of the market that you're dabbling with. I mean, what is sort of hot at the moment? Is it particular models or is it price led?
Well, the two sites, so the new select site we have, which is £4,000 to £10,000 retail, and then the other site, which is the original one, anything over 10,000 to say 45,000-50,000 goes up there, and that's the main Shiremore site. Now that still sold more cars than the select site for last month and the month before. At the select site, I can't remember how many they did last month. We probably had about 80 available, and I think they probably, I can't remember, it was something like they might have done about 50 sales. And again, under the £10,000 mark, quite a lot of small family hatches where people are downsizing. There was some cars going to quite a lot for first-time drivers, you know, people who just passed the driving test, people who are maybe 19 and they've never had a car, that kind of thing. And then the other, what we have found slow down is probably mid-range stuff, which normally sells really well. So say a cash cow for say £15,000 kind of mark, or a Focus, one of these ST line things at about 15,000-17,000 miles. They've dropped, well, for us, they've dropped right off. So it's either the lower end or also the topper end. So £20,000 plus, we've still been doing well with those, you know, BMs and Jags, all that kind of stuff, still been selling.
And where are you getting your stuff from? Where do you get most of your stock from?
Well, we've got a car buying website, which we try and buy as many as we can via that. But that's difficult, and it's just saturated up and down the country. So it's difficult trying to market that. I've got three buyers now who work for the company. I've got a guy based in Scotland who does really good, and we've got two in the Northeast. They're on all the auctions, so, you know, G3, Aston Bartley, you know, BCA, Mannheim, and so on. So we tend to get them like that. And then what we're trying to do is obviously generate the part exchanges from the more expensive cars down to, so the cheaper cars at the select site, it's quite a lot gets filtered through from part exchanges where previously we used to trade out of those.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm finding a lot of dealers are doing that now. Sort of keeping their own, these part exchanges that they're not doing. Another used car dealer I was talking to a couple of weeks back is exactly the same story that you've said. They were a little bit worried about that 4 to 10 grand market because it takes more prep and the danger of it bouncing back is quite high. But actually at the moment, it's the stuff that's selling and they're getting a steady supply of them coming through as part exchanges. So I don't think you're alone in doing that. Scott, well, my question to you would be, I mean, with my new project, what do you think I should start with? What should I buy first?
A Renault Clio, by the sounds of it.
Renault Clio, yeah.
Clio's the other day. So are you setting up a similar kind of business from the start?
Yeah. So yeah, we're starting a used car dealership, but we're using AI as much as possible. So it's a project, but also it is a genuine business, a real business that we've just started. We're running it as a video series on the website, talking about it on the podcast. But we're just sort of getting to the stage now where we need to start buying the first few cars. So, but I'm going to be selling the first few from home, like you did when you started up. So
I mean, just from personal experience, was start small, low risk, you know, like I said before, we got funding in, but until then, it was just a matter of keeping it really tight. The guy who we purchased the site from in Shiremore, he said he was like an old school kind of car dealer. He's well known. He says, if I can give you a bit of advice, son, he says, take what you need and not what you can. And I've always like stuck by it because there's so many car dealers and they have like, you know, lifestyle businesses and, you know, nice cars and, you know, holidays and, you know, they're living the dream, but they rinse everything out of the business. We try and leave everything in the business to try and reinvest it and grow it. So, you know, things like funding, if they call it when the job goes off, if the job goes off and the funding comes, you know, the knocking, you need to have money there, you know, so it's trying to get the right balance, I would have said.
Yeah. Well, I'll stop probing you for advice, Scott, and we'll crack on with some stories, but thank you very much for the insight into your business. Thanks for that.
So James and I are going to run through our favourite stories of the week. And at the end, Scott gets to decide whose stories were the best and who is the winner. I won last week, so I'm going to go first, which I don't think James is going to argue with because he's on quite a lot of medication. However, I am going to start, actually. I'm going to get this out of the way. I'm going to talk about your AI dealership this week, James.
So
we've published a new video as of about 6 o'clock last night. In case anyone was wondering, nothing really has happened as yet, but
how dare you? How dare you? You've really talked down the episode three of this amazing project, John.
Well, yeah, okay. So there's where you're at is you've canvassed a lot of opinion, haven't you? And you've worked out what you want to do and you've set up a name and all this sort of stuff. Where we're up to is the very boring stuff this week, isn't it? Which is, but very important things, such as setting up the company, setting up a bank account, setting up all those bits and pieces, website and so on and so forth, which we didn't actually touch on much this week, the website. But yes, you've had some stumbling blocks, haven't you? So the first thing was Companies House,
yeah,
where you registered your company on Companies House and then went to pay £12 or whatever the amount is, and then it broke. So great success there. But you are now registered, aren't you? So this is a company. It's a proper company.
The Clever Car Collection Limited.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you'll be ready to trade very soon. However, bank accounts, James.
It's been an absolute nightmare. I mean, you'll see the story on the website published today, John. Why do banks hate used car dealers so much is the headline. I am honestly, I did not think this would be so difficult to set up. I've been turned down by six banks now. I've tried a lot of the online-based ones, the likes of Tide, Starling, Monzo. And because they are all app-based, you go through the process and you do it all and take a picture of your face and et cetera, and maybe that's what's putting them off, actually. But they eventually turn you down, some of them incredibly rapidly. One of them, and I can't remember which one it was, said they don't deal with used car dealers. They don't deal with the car trade. And I even spoke to our bank, you know, the Blackball Media's Car Dealer Magazine's bank. I spoke to the bank manager there who was very nice and very happy to talk to me. But when I started explaining what the new project was and what the new business, you could sort of see the mood change. You know, I could hear it in his voice. And I don't really understand why the banking industry just doesn't like used car dealers so much. And it's a real stumbling block for me because I've got the seed investment ready to go to put into this new business. I want to start going and buy the cars, but I can't do it because I haven't got a bank account set up. I mean, okay, I could probably do it via, you know, my own private account and make sure it's all accounted properly in the new business accounts, but that's complicated. I want to keep this as clean as possible. So yeah, I'm quite shocked, John, how difficult it's been to set up a bank account.
That was the surprise for me. I mean, it's surprising that you've been turned down by six, but it was this. I think you actually send a video. It's more than one bank, just to get cut through your morphine haze. A couple of banks said to you they don't do. As soon as you put used car dealership, it was pretty much disqualified immediately.
Yeah,
which is sort of incredible, really, because it's to cut out an entire sector of retail just like that, and quite a lot of money, you would think. Why would they do that? I don't quite understand. I don't understand it.
But before we get on to the second part of this, I just wanted to ask Scott's kind of opinion on that, really. I mean, Scott, what have you found with banks over the years? And is it me that's the problem? Or do you think this is just a general industry issue that the banks don't love used car dealers?
No, I totally agree. I think it could be across the board. We set up a business during the lockdown, which was one of these competition companies. And that was an absolute nightmare. No bank would entertain it. We even spoke to Metro Bank. And it was to do with the transactions on where, you know, when you raffle the cars off and you sell tickets. A few people had a go, and we got in too late, to be fair. But that was a nightmare. And we're busy setting up another company now. And I've got a business partner, and he's with Barclays. I've got another business with Barclays. So we're both on their system, which has probably helped. But that was still, it's still not set up yet, but we've had to jump through lots of hurdles to try and get there. When I first set up Redgate Lodge, I went into Lloyds Bank and asked them for a business account, and they made it very difficult. I think they said they were going to do an overdraft of about £500, which I think at the time I probably had more in my pocket. You know, when you're selling cars from the door, it's all cash. So no, it is very difficult. Very difficult.
So when did you eventually get your first account? Did you have to do some trading in a slightly different way first before you actually managed to get it? Or
no, I think my wife had a bank account with Santander, just a personal account in Morpeth in Northumberland, and then she went in and spoke to somebody, and then we got an account with them. And then as the business grew, I don't know if we've probably got about 8 or 9 accounts with them now, because you get like savings accounts and various other ones. So once you're in there, and then the guy who looks after us, he's actually from corporate banking, but he looks after us from Santander, and his predecessor used to as well. So I've got him on my mobile phone if I need a ring, and so on. So I think once you get the account there and you get the relationship built, it helps, but trying to get it off from the start, I understand. Yeah, it's very.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it's not just me, but fingers crossed. I've got a current application in with Barclays that has gone a lot further than the others, i.e., I haven't been turned down within 24 hours. So,
I mean, I must say, I thought it was flipped around. I thought it would be really difficult to register the company and really easy to get a bank account because, I mean, to get yourself a personal bank account takes, I mean, to get a Monzo account takes 5 minutes, doesn't it?
Yeah, but that's exactly what I was thinking.
Obviously not.
The second part of this, John, if you don't mind me just talking about it, is this sort of kind of, as we went on this week, John's obviously editing these videos for me as part of this project, so we're working very closely together on it. And there wasn't much happening, as John's rightly pointed out, quite a lot of admin, etc. But then I had this opportunity for my first deal. So I'll let the cat out of the bag on this one. My ex-wife actually contacted me and said, I really need a car. I get on very well with my ex-wife, which is handy. I mean, after this, maybe not. But she said to me, I really need a car. Her car is on lease at the moment. It's going back in 6 days' time. She wants a mini estate of some form, clubman or countryman. So I said, oh, yeah, I'll go out and have a look and try and find something for you. Eventually, within very few searches, found something on Motorway that was pretty much perfect. So it was a Countryman all four Cooper SD, 67,000 miles, decent specification, had sat nav, was in black. She must have an automatic, she says. So it was an auto too. So I went back with her, sent the pictures, said, look, this is the specification. And I did my sums. You know, on Motorway, it says what it starts at, and it says what the reserve price is. It also gives you the cap retail price on there. So I sort of kind of work back from there. I mean, Scott, you're going to have to tell me if I'm doing this completely wrong. You've been doing it a lot longer than I have. But I work back from there. I took off the £350 delivery charge. I worked in the buyer's fee, which is like £300. And I thought, well, I put a bit of margin in there for, it's obviously my ex-wife, so as a friend, I wanted to make sure she was looked after, but I still put about 500 quid margin in it, plus a little bit of money to do some prep work, a valet, etc. So I put my bid in with that in mind, at just over £5,000. No, it was £5,000, which was above what it was cap clean and also well above what their reserve was listed at. The car eventually sold out. So I'd said to my ex-wife, had agreed to buy it for £6,500. So I put the bid in at five, giving me that little bit of margin. The car eventually sold on Motorway for £6,300. And I thought, I was honestly shocked. I mean, I thought, how on earth? Because obviously that's a dealer that's bought that. I mean, what am I missing? Like, was
so you can moderate this, Scott, because James has said this to me, and my immediate thought was, well, probably, James, cap is a guide, and a car is worth as much as someone is willing to pay for it. And with something like a top spec mini, maybe it's not all about the figures. It's about what you think you can sell it for.
Well, maybe this is where I got. Obviously, I'm very new to this, so all I was working on that cap figure, the cap retail figure, and I thought, well, that's got to be the fair price, and that's where I started at what I thought she would pay for it, and then work back. So I was quite shocked when the trade price comes in at the end of the auction, £6,300, and I'm left high and dry. So I had to go back to her and say, I told her it was in an auction and explain the situation. And she was understanding, but I had the deal there ready to be done. It was sort of kind of signed. I just needed to buy the car, but I failed. Where did I go wrong, Scott?
I think first of all, the first mistake you've made is you only had £500 profit for your ex-wife. That should have maybe been about 2,000 or 2,500. That's the first thing, definitely. Depends how much you got off you in the divorce.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I think, like John said, cap, sometimes I don't understand it. You know, even back in the days when physical auctions were there and you stand with a catalogue and you look at the catalogue and it's capping at this and the cars are doing that, I always think it's a bit baffling. But we go from Auto Trader retail, so if my advice would have been to look on Auto Trader, find that same car on Auto Trader, see what it's retailing at, and then work back from that.
Yeah, I'm talking to Auto Trader at the moment and the other advertising platforms, and I'm due to go in and see Auto Trader for a bit of guidance in the new year, which will form part of a video. And I mean, part of that, I really want access to the data. I want access to the pricing, like you say, because you can do it yourself, can't you, manually? But if you've got an account on AutoTrader, you can put that reg in and it tells you what you should price it at.
Yeah, exactly.
I need to sort of get to that place. I mean, what I'm finding is it's going to be a steep learning curve, but it was quite positive that there was a deal there to be done. And I tried, but unfortunately failed.
But yeah, so if anyone's listening and they've got a black mini, whatever on earth it is, Countryman that they want to shift,
Clubman,
get in touch.
Yeah. Please do. Yeah.
Automatic ceremony.
A willing buyer and she needs it within 6 days. So I'm working hard to try and find one.
When I first started, I attended for 3 months auctions before I bought a car. I used to go at the auctions, watch all the prices, watch who bought them for, who bought the cars. And then I got to know who they were. And then I would see the cars appear on their websites. And then you'd work out what the margins are working from. Mm. And I used to do it like that before I actually put my hand up. But when I put my hand up and bought one, it was like just nerves, you know, it was the first one.
See, that's proper research, that. And that is food for thought for James, who is going to an auction on Monday.
I am. But you've got to remember, I'm trying to use AI with this as much as possible. So as we start buying the cars, I'm going to start deploying AI. And then I've got someone else to blame. We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights. Right, I'll move us on. And I am going to take us away from the AI side of things and move us towards lookers, which unfortunately has been what can only be described as a car crash this week. There's been some horrendous news coming out of that business. So rewind the clock a few weeks. This is the business that was sold to the Canadians for £502.4 million, took them off the stock market and into private hands. And since that's happened, we've found that they're having to make some quite drastic changes. On Monday, very sadly, all 160 dealerships were told that their sales staff were going to be at risk of redundancies. They're making big cuts there, and all of their business managers are up for redundancy too. In total, 650 people at risk. That equates to 10% of the lookers' workforce. This is on the back of 200 people at risk at head office following the move from a public company into private hands. So they're losing some of those functions that were a part of the PLC business. But also Charles Hirst, the franchise dealer subsidiary in Northern Ireland, part of Lookers, they've got 100 job losses. And then this morning, I mean, following off the back of this story that I wrote on Tuesday, we've been contacted by huge numbers of Lookers staff via LinkedIn, via email, who've been emailing us in and sort of kind of giving us more detail about what's actually happened. And the most recent one is that yesterday they were told that all Christmas parties have been cancelled. So the company's cancelled Christmas. And then they've also put the service departments at risk as well. One of the engineers contacted us saying that in his business, there's four mechanics and they're losing one of them. So 25% in that business. And he thinks that sort of cut is going to be replicated across the business. We've gone to Lookers and all of this. They've confirmed that they are making these cuts. They've confirmed again that the service departments are also at risk of redundancy. And I think the thing here is, this is obviously, it's now in new hands. This business is in new hands. They bought Lookers via a consortium of three banks. It's a huge, huge loan that they've got. And if you look back at how much they made 2022, £80 million profit, huge part of that is going to be wiped out by the these debt repayments they're going to have to make.
With interest rates being as they are,
With interest rates especially, John, yes. And they've obviously looked at this coming, looked at the downturn we're seeing slightly in the industry at the moment, seeing the crash in used car prices. And it feels to me like they're panicking a little bit. They made no notifications ahead of this deal going through, or when it was proposed that this sort of redundancy level was going to happen so quickly after they took over. And I think this is what the feeling that we're getting from staff is, they are shocked that this has happened. You know, there's never a good time for redundancies, but you know, we're 10 days before Christmas. This is 2 weeks before Christmas. These are real lives, real families being impacted by these cuts. I mean, surely they should have thought about this a bit further.
Well, there's some people said they were given, you know, senior staff members were given hours, plural, of notice to announce this to their staff, as you say, a week before Christmas.
And you mentioned, didn't you, I think last week on the podcast, that the story that Mark Raban, the CEO, is going. Yeah. He's clearly had enough. He's done an incredible job over the last few years, pulling his business back from all those accounting issues they had to turned it around during the pandemic, really. And he's obviously seen that there's some big changes with new owners coming down the road, and obviously doesn't want to be part of it. I'm assuming, of course, but you know, you've got to read between the lines on these sorts of things. But devastating news. But the one thing I would just like to say on this, John, is I've posted these stories on LinkedIn this week, and I've been really impressed by the way that the industry has come together. There's so many comments on this post from other businesses saying, we're really sorry to hear this. These are the jobs that we've got available. I've been through this before. If anybody wants to talk to me, just pick up the phone. I mean, James Brearley, formerly of Inchcape, now working at Peter Vardy, said, if anybody wants to pick up the phone and talk to him and get some advice on what to do in this situation, they can do. It's fell, and it's the same's happened again this morning, because I published this story about the service department colleagues who were impacted. Exactly the same thing's happened. All of these nice comments and opportunities are sort of coming together on LinkedIn. And that is what I do love about this industry, is that sometimes that when the chips are down, we're pretty good at coming together, and I think that's sort of proven it. But horrendous times at Lookers, if I'm honest, it's just, as I said at the start, it's been an absolute car crash, and I just think it could have been handled so much better.
It's such a shame as well, because job losses are horrendous, and this is not a nice time to have it happen at all. But on top of that, you think, if you look at the Lookers business itself, this is how to single-handedly destroy whatever culture was there in one fell swoop, isn't it? I mean, this is not going to feel like a nice place to work for the people that are still there. I mean, somebody that emailed us said the new CEO, boss, whatever he is, has been pretty much invisible. He's not really made himself, his presence known, has he? In terms of, you know, if you think back to Marshall, I think Dash would always go around and visit dealerships and so on. And I bought a car from Marshall, and you open the booklet and there's a big photo of Dash and it's da da da. I think it's not really been, it's not a personal enterprise, this, is it? You do look at it and think, why did he buy it? Or why did they buy it? This selection of banks and him, because it's obviously not proving to work very well.
No.
They've chosen to fund it.
It's been, very upsetting to write about, and I'm very upsetting to hear from these people, because, you know, I really do feel, why don't they just wait until after Christmas? I mean, I know it doesn't make any difference, two weeks. It's bad news whenever it comes, but, you know, it's particularly bad news. You ruin these poor people's Christmas. That's all they're going to be thinking about, all they're going to be worried about. But just, I think that the important thing is, like, these people need to stay positive. There are so many opportunities out there that have been posted on LinkedIn. And the other thing is, Ben, the automotive industry charity, posted on there that they have got a helpline. People can call it, they can get advice, they can go onto the Ben website. This has happened before, and there are other opportunities out there. So I think I'd say to those people, like, stay positive, stay positive where you can.
Absolutely.
Scott, have you got any comments on that one? I mean, if you haven't, I mean, it's fine if you haven't. But
no, I think it's very sad. I hate to see any business fail. I think my new good new operations director, who was at Lucas for 16 years, and JCT was like senior management level, and we spoke about this in the summer, and I think he's still quite, you know, he still knows people who were in the business, and it was pretty much on the cards. A lot of it are redundancies of what we're going to be coming. We've secured two technicians this week from Lucas, which is good, and we've had some. There's a lady applied for an admin position with us as well. So I think, you know, in the industry itself, those who good people are hard to find. But I think that the people who they don't need to worry, because, you know, whether there's a shortage of technicians, there's a shortage of good people out there. So I think from Lucas, people they shouldn't, you know, worry. But I agree with you. I think they've been a bit short-sighted in what they've done and panicked, I think.
Yeah. It does feel like it. It certainly feels like it. The comments I'm having from people who just, when they see the story come out and text me off the back of it, it's just, you know, the words car crash have been used a lot this week.
Yeah.
It certainly feels like it. Right, John, pick up the mood.
Okay. I am going to move us on, if I can find the right tab in my browser, to Marshall, which is a nib of a story this week, which is another Marshall dealership has disappeared into new hands. So this is, it's a VW dealership in Tunbridge Wells, my neck of the woods, Kent, and it's been bought by JCB Group. So in effect, this is another dealership disappearing from Marshall's portfolio. Obviously, we like to keep mentioning that a lot of Toyota and Lexus ones disappeared. That was a bit of a big hit to them. They had a Volvo dealership they got rid of in the summer, didn't they?
Yeah.
It's just sort of like the slow leaking of dealerships by Marshall. But very nice news for JCB, who get another dealership in. I mean, I think Kent is JCB Group's sort of home turf as well. Certainly quite a few JCB Group dealerships that I've seen in Kent.
The thing on this, John, is I know Dash place such high importance on the Volkswagen brand and the Marshall business. I mean, it was the sort of jewel in the crown, because he had a huge number of them in the home counties. And he said, you know, if you can't sell Volkswagens in the home counties, you're not going to be able to sell them anywhere. And, you know, it's a beautiful dealership that they've bought. And I think this, for me, this is a worrying one again, because it's yet another business that's leaving Marshall's following the Constellation acquisition. And, you know, is it because the manufacturer's not happy with the performance? I mean, we've seen what's happened to the Marshall business in the last few months, and since Dash has gone, and it's gone downhill. So I think this is a bit of a worry.
This is actually an ex-Motorline dealership. I was just having a look.
Is it? So yeah, another one that they acquired as part of that big deal just before Dash left.
Yeah.
Interesting one. Right. Yeah. Unless you've got anything more on that,
nope.
I will move us on to some positive news in the industry. And that was news of a huge acquisition by Sytner. The American company behind Sytner is obviously Penske Automotive Group, that had been put his hat in the ring for the as part of the Pendragon deal, didn't it? As part of that saga, but he's actually put his hands in his pocket and bought a chain of showrooms from Rybrook. So I heard that there was a deal in the offing on the rumor mill for Sytner a little while ago, but I couldn't actually get any more information other than the fact that they were buying someone, and buying someone big is what I'd been told. And this clearly is a big deal. Four BMW showrooms, four Mini, four Volvo sites, two Land Rover dealerships, one Porsche, and three BMW motorbike dealerships as part of this. So this will, I think it adds $1 billion dollars, around $800 million in annual revenue. We know that the car dealer top 100, Sytner, are the biggest by revenue. They're still behind Arnold Clark on how we rank that table on EBITDA profit. But, you know, with a deal like this, I can see them slowly start chomping away at that lead that Arnold Clark has got. But yeah, huge congratulations to Darren Edwards and the Sytner team. Nice to see a big deal going through. And I wouldn't be surprised if this isn't the last one we see. I'm pretty sure Sytner will be still out there shopping. They bought this one, John, unlike the Canadians, with their own cash. So no funding, just wrote a check out.
Like
they're buying a Range Rover.
Well, I can't say I'm hugely surprised because it fits very nicely into their selection of brands, doesn't it? As you say, mostly BMW and Mini, Land Rover. I think Volvo might be new to Sydney now. I don't think they've got any Volvo dealerships. So that's a new one for them. We'll see how that slots into their portfolio. But yes, I'm sure more to come.
Nice to see a big deal going through, and congratulations to the Sytner team. Do you have any dealings, Scott, with Sytner? I mean, I was talking to a few used car dealers who buy a lot from their auctions, buy a lot from their Sytner auction.
I have bought from the Sytner auction many years ago, and then I think did they buy out car? Was it car shop they bought out? Yeah. So a lot of the cars what they used to put on the auction then went to down to car shop. So the amount what got offered on there wasn't as good. I bought a BMW from Sytner down next to London earlier on this year. That was, I don't know, it was about a year old, the car, 7 Series. I bought it for my wife hadn't been well, so I thought I'd buy a 7 Series, it would be nice. But the wheels were buckled, and there was the car had to go back. There was from a customer's point of view, I didn't have a good time, but I think they're a great outfit in general. I think they're
And
good.
we've been to see a few of their businesses,
Oh,
John
yeah.
and I, when we did some videos there, and chatted to Darren Edwards, and it is an amazing business, very, very well set up, and just a beautifully old machine. I find the other thing I find with Sytner is everybody that I talk to in that business is just a really nice person. Like, they're always really friendly, really polite, really helpful. And it doesn't matter where you sort of deal with them in the chain, wherever they are, they're that sort of person. So I think it just goes back to the importance of culture and having the right people in your business that makes it a success.
I think I was just unlucky with my buying experience. It didn't go particularly well. And the guy who was looking after it, he'd only been in the sales for about 2 months. He was ex policeman, so he was the car. So I think he was still in his training phase. Maybe, just my just personal. That was just buying one car, though.
Yeah, sounds quite unusual, I think, when it comes to Sytner. Right, John, back to you.
Okay, I will squeeze in a top 10 used car profit margins.
Oh, really?
Data from, well, November's Dealer Auction Retail Margin Monitor, catchily titled. And the most profitable car is the Range Rover Evoque. £5,100 of profit, James. And the
Well,
data
John,
out.
just on this one, can I just jump in very quickly? Because I did get chastised by one of our podcast listeners about this story. He sent
Oh,
me
did
a
you?
message on LinkedIn, and wanted to point out how actually there is a it, that might be the figures that they're saying, but they've not taken into account any of the fees, any of the delivery costs, any of the recon, or any of the warranty work that may be needed afterwards, which was a very valid point. So thank you to that listener who knows who he is.
I don't know what you're talking about because the what warranty work on a Range Rover? I don't. It's perfect. I'm sure as it comes out the factory. Well,
Well,
I'm taking that aside, and that's a very valid point. That a Range Rover, the Evoque, is the most profitable on this list. Second is the Mercedes A-Class, Hyundai Tucson, Volvo XC60, C-Class, Cougar, 3 Series, Mini Countryman in eighth. James, would you like to know the figure for that one?
oh no, go on. I can't even. I wrote this story, but it was one of those ones I did at like 3 in the morning, so I can't remember
Yeah,
what it
probably
was
before you tried to buy a Mini Countryman as well. £2,925 dealer auctions that you should be making on that.
like.
Yeah, what were you aiming for? About 500 quid?
500. And I didn't even make that, did I? I
No.
don't think I'm going to be very good at this.
Well, there you
Okay.
go. So, I mean, if you
Just
want the
talking about.
inspiration as to what
Just
car
talking
to
about.
buy, there you go.
Thank you, John. Just talking about those Range Rover and Land Rover products. I'd just like to remind you of the conversation you might not have heard last night at our Christmas party with our sales manager, who needs to buy a 7-seater car. This is Kev, and he was adamant that he wanted to buy a Land Rover Discovery. And no matter what I said to him about it being the most unreliable car you could buy, he was convinced that this was the car for him. But which leads me to the point that it doesn't matter how much you do in the car business, where people ask you for advice, but then they will never, ever take it.
It's true. It's absolutely true. Isn't the same true of your brother who wanted a Range Rover Sport and you tried to get him into
Yes.
a Volvo?
Yes. People don't, yeah. And I tried to
People don't
convince
listen
Kevin
to
to buy
us.
Volvo, but they don't. I think Volvo still have this stigma that they are not a cool car and they're an old man's car, where actually it's completely opposite. I think Volvo's brilliant.
I agree. I
think Scott, you must have this. You must have people asking you all the time, like friends and family, what your opinion on stuff and what to buy. Do you find it annoying as well when they don't listen to you?
Yeah. I mean, I actually ran a Discovery during the pandemic. I bought a brand new and I had it for 2.5 years and it never folded once.
Don't tell. You've got the only one. Well done.
The only one, yeah. And we've had a few in the family. You know, my wife's had Range Rover Sports. I've had Vogues and things like that. And I had one. There was a few niggles on it. But in general, I've been lucky. And then when we sell them, they then seem to develop all these faults, which is strange.
Oh, no.
I think the brand, you've just got to expect them to falter. It's a bit like, you know, in the 80s, it was Alfa Romeo. People used to say, oh, don't buy an Alfa because they'll just break down. But people still used to buy them. And I think that's probably the same with Land Rover. You can maybe get a lucky one. I think it's important that they get serviced at the main dealers for all the updates and things like that. I think that helps.
Do you buy them then? Do you avoid them?
It's a bit of a mix. We're trying to avoid them. We'll buy the Evoques. They're okay. We've done the odd Velar. Range Rover Sports, I always find them quite hard work, and we don't stock the Vogues, the big ones.
Yeah.
I think the problem is when they go to auction, because of the grading at the auction, you know, they'll say, you know, the gearbox first in reverse, the car's fine, but then there's a gearbox fault, which is going to cost you 10 grand. You know, because of the auction grading, the auction's limited on what information they can give you about the car. When they've all got suspension faults and ride high, you know, brakes, and you know, they can be riddled with faults, which doesn't actually come into play with the grading. So when the dealers, like sort of us, when we buy them, it's known in the motor trade, they say, oh, you've got to have a lot of money across one of those to fix it, to prep it, and then allow some for when it comes back for late costs coming in. So that's why the margin's probably, as it is from the start, it's probably a bit of a false margin at the start.
Yeah, I suppose I can understand that. You need a lot of meat in it because you're going to lose a lot of it as you start prepping. I think. Yeah.
And if you hit unlucky and it doesn't come back, well, then you've done well. You know, it's all right. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. True. I don't know if I'm prepared to take those gambles.
I wouldn't tell. No. Keep away.
Yeah. Right. I've got my last story for you, John. And that is about how crashing used EV prices can teach all car dealers a lesson. And this is from a news story from Estelle Miller, who is from award-winning used EV dealership of the year, EV Experts. And Estelle is going to be on one of my panels at Car Dealer Live 2024. And this is the event that we're going to be holding at the British Motor Museum at Gaydon on March the 7th. And we've got a number of different panels. We've got independent dealer panel, we've got franchise one, manufacturers, luxury cars. And we're going to be talking about all things used cars, but also just about the industry in general. And one of the topics that Estelle, I popped in actually to this dealership and chatted to them. I've now spoken about it on the podcast before. And they've, as you can imagine, have had a very, very difficult 2023. EV prices have absolutely tanked, as we know. They only sell EVs, but they have actually managed to make a success of it. And they actually said that now they're obviously buying again. They need to keep these cars, need to keep their showroom stocked up. And there's some good margins in them because lots of other dealers are put off by them. And Estelle said that when I spoke to her, that actually what they've learned and how they managed that situation over the last year was quite vast. You know, they got a lot of experience with this difficult situation. And now we're seeing this happen with petrol and diesel cars. We're seeing used car prices drop 8.4% in the last 2 months, 18% since April. So at Car Dealer Live, we're going to be talking about this and talking about how we can manage that. So there's a story on the website all about what she said and details of how you can get tickets at cardealerlive.co.uk. Thanks.
Good
for
plug
the
there. Thank Good you. Plug. Thank you. It's a tough time to be a used car dealer, isn't it?
Sounds like it, doesn't it?
I'm not sure I'd recommend it at this exam. Well,
ChatGPT thought it was a great idea, John.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So are you going to buy a Nissan Leaf then? Is that your first?
Probably not. Scott, do you stock any EVs?
I've never had one. No, never, ever. We've got a couple of hybrids at the moment, and they're just, I call them in the red on Auto Trader. The views and the clicks on them are really poor, even though they're nice cars, but I don't know.
Really?
And they're just petrol hybrids. Yeah, I was struggling.
So what it was, it's obviously a conscious decision not to buy EVs. So, I mean, what is it that put you off about it?
I think that in the northeast, probably the structure, which is probably the same as the rest of the UK. And I think that, a couple of years ago was price on how much they were originally, costing. Joe, it's all right if you're in a business and you're getting one as a company car. I was talking to a guy yesterday, and they were on Teslas from Newcastle, and they had a site over at Carlisle, and they said that they can get over to Carlisle and did what they needed to do, and then they were having to charge, and they'll have to drive north up the motorway to try and find the charging point, because there was one not available and things. So there's all that kind of stuff which goes around. But I think the main problem is probably the prices dropping. You just that they were coming down quite a lot.
Well, and I think the EV is going to be a nightmare next year, because we've got huge targets to hit when it comes to what the manufacturers need to sell. 22% of their fleet needs to be electric cars at a time when no one wants to buy them. So how do you incentivize these buyers to, especially retail buyers, to go into these cars when they don't want them and they're more expensive? I think that's going to be the big challenge next year. I really do.
I think as well, if you had something like a 5-year-old or 4-year-old Tesla or something, the battery was to suddenly fail. I know that it's not necessarily common for them to all of a sudden fail, but if they did fail, trying to, the warranty, I think there's not many warranty providers now putting the warranty on the batteries.
So the Model S I saw on CarWow this week at 22 grand, avoid is what you're saying.
But free charging for life still, if it'll charge,
If
if
it'll charge,
Model
yeah. But
S.
when that, yeah, I don't think I need someone coming back saying my battery's gone pop on my Tesla. That would be pretty painful, wouldn't it?
Probably not. What I find quite interesting about this, because we ask, or you particularly, James, ask pretty much everyone who comes on the podcast, are you stocking any EVs? And the resounding answer we tend to get is, well, there's not really anything in between yes or no, is there? It's
No.
either no, I'm not going anywhere near them at the minute, or yes, it's all we stock.
Yeah.
Like, it's got very divided. And I would have thought, as we transition more to EVs, that, and as
Bravery.
we've probably preached on the website for, I don't know, 3 years, that dealers need to get ready for the EV revolution and put charges in, all this sort of stuff. And if anything, I think the last 12 months has probably stopped, people from putting it into their general mix. Either they are fully EV or they're just not at all going to go near them.
Yeah.
Which is slightly concerning in itself, isn't it? But there
Yeah.
we are.
Well,
Who can blame them, though? Who can blame them?
that's my stories, John. So it's you.
I've also run out.
Have you?
So, Scott, before we ask for your verdict, are there any stories we've missed this week?
I don't think you've missed anything, no.
That's what we like to hear.
Comprehensive. Like it.
Excellent. Those 4 a.m. starts for James have not been in vain. So I'm going to have to
No.
ask you, who chose the best stories? Who is your winner? Or which stories were your favorite, if you can't remember who said them, because I can't at this point.
I've actually wrote them down.
Oh.
I'm going to go with John with the new business setup for the AI. Has to be.
I did not think choosing that would get me into the winning position, I have to say.
Yeah, I think that
But
one. And the Sittner story was good as well. I think that was all very positive. All the stories were good. Luca's very sad for what's going on there. So, yeah.
oh, well, congratulations, John. But I will also take that as a win because I wrote the story. So that is handy.
Thank you.
And a slight plug for next week, because on Monday to Wednesday next week, I'm heading to Carkey. Another used car award winner, Jamie Capel, is going to be hosting me for 3 days of used car dealer work experience for James Baggett. So tune in next week to see how badly that
Yeah, unless he sacks you after one day, of course,
went,
which is.
which is probably the case.
Who's this slow-moving person hobbling around my dealership with a limp?
Yeah.
He's got to go. Okay, well, on that very strange note, all that's left for me to say is thank you to Scott for judging today. It's been great to have you on. And best of luck with the business.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the invite, and have a fantastic Christmas.
Yeah, and you,
And
Scott. Thank
you.
you. Thank you
Yeah.
very much.
Okay.
And thank you as well to James for managing to sit in the same position for nearly an hour. And thank you
Well,
for listening.
yeah, you're very welcome, John. That will be the morphine.
I'll wheel you towards another room now.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week with another episode, so make sure you'll subscribe so you can be notified when that goes live. If you want to check out the stories we've mentioned today, you can click the links in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Thanks for listening and goodbye.